So now that we're moving here, let's go to page 250, 251. And here, quite a few pages to go through, because here's where you do see that intersection between Wagnerian culture and German political culture. But more interestingly, the how Heinrich, we sit around and argue in articles and at conferences and sometimes even more publicly in the Knesset, for that matter, whether or not Wagner should be read as anti-Semitic, or whether or not Wagner should be read as an icon of German nationalism or German patriotism. And most of that is based on our present-day interpretations of Wagner's music. Okay, and the missing piece in that whole argument is, well, what did Germans think then? Okay, do we know? Do we really know that they perceived Wagner as anti-Semitic? Right? And what we know is there were plenty of intellectuals out there who were arguing about these various positions. Wagner as the modernist, Wagner as the sort of psychiatrist, psychologist, Wagner as the patriot, nationalist, Wagner as the romantic, Wagner as the anti-Semitic. Okay? And so there were certainly people writing in those each of those veins. Right? Most prevalently that folkish vein. But, you know, if you knew literature and if you knew people like Thomas Mann, you would know there's that other Wagner, that progressive Wagner, that none of us would be that uncomfortable with. Right? So they're all out there. And it's on the basis of that that most of our present-day discourse goes on. Because there aren't that many people who are looking down at the sources to see, okay, did this have impact? And what sources are there? Well, newspaper articles. Maybe some letters to the editor, diary records. I mean, how do you find out what every average individual thinks? And that's a pretty tough order. Are you going to go through every diary you can find in Germany? You know, how many of them are published? Records of working class meetings. Those are the kind of things you have to look for to see what impact art has on the common culture. So it's welcome when we have Heinrich Mann, who doesn't have any particular investment in the Wagner issue, unless he's countering his brother's worship of Wagner as a progressive, as a modern, that's possible. So if you're going to analyze this, you say, well, it could be that Heinrich Mann is presenting this satirical image of how Wagner was understood by someone like Dietrich as a way of zinging his brother who held Wagner up so high. Right? So that's a possibility. You would take that into account if you're going to hold up this argument. But here we have a contemporary author who's assuming this realist approach, which presumes scientific accuracy as much as an author can provide that, right? In the interest of reforming society and perhaps critiquing it toward improvement, right? So all that has to be taken into account. But it's rare that we have, okay, let's listen in on what your average patriotic German thought about Wagner and see if that doesn't help us to understand the impact that Wagner had on German society as a whole. Okay. So they attend a performance of Lohengrin. I'm going to restrain myself from telling you the whole story of Lohengrin, even if I knew it, but in the end, Lohengrin's this wonderful white knight who comes into a society and saves the day, more or less. We'll just put it that way for now. Huste remarked that this was nothing compared to the production that Lohengrin put on in Berlin, page 251. The curtains rose, and all she was giggling disparagingly. Heavens, look at Ortrud. She's wearing a dressing gown and a corset. Dietrich was paying more attention to the king under the oak tree, by all appearances the most prominent personality. So, one, you know, we know we're dealing with some satire here, because he's saying, well, they're not really paying attention to the story or the magic or the composition of the music and all of the things that intellectuals concentrate on. They're just responding to how the, you know, the costuming works and whether that appeals to them and all. His words, however, were perfectly sound from a national point of view. Okay. To defend the empire's honor in the East and in the West. Bravo! Every time the king saying the word German, he thrust his hand upward, and the music, for its part, substantiated the sentiment. In other respects, as well as the music, the music underscored vigorously what one was supposed to hear. Vigorous, that was the word. Dietrich wished he had had such music when he gave his speech in the sewer debate. Okay, so he likes the German, he likes the imagery, the defending the empire's honor. He likes the fact that the music, you know, rises when those kinds of terms are communicated. It's not a sophisticated reading, but he's responding to those aspects. This discovery prompted Dietrich to take a closer look at the faces of the other vassals, and he found Neo-Teutons everywhere. Their paunches and beards had grown considerably, and they had clad themselves against the tough times in plate armor. It also seemed that not all of them had attained favorable positions in life. The noblemen looked like middle-level public servants of the Middle Ages, with leathery faces and knock knees, and those of lesser birth looked even less dashing. So he's projecting his own experience onto the opera, right? And he sees, you know, various types of his fraternity buddies in the crowd in the chorus of the opera. Dietrich noticed from the very beginning that he felt quite at home in this opera. Shields and swords, lots of clanking armor, patriotic sentiments, ha, and hail, and upraised banners, and the German oak tree. It nearly made one want to play along. Okay, so he likes all of this fundamental surface Germanness, at least in this production, with the shields and the swords and the clanking armor, the banners, and the general Germanic symbolism. Now, here's an aside, but it's relevant. It shows how these things play themselves out. After the Second World War, it becomes almost impossible in Germany to produce a performance of Wagner's operas with traditional costuming, scenery, and choreography. Okay, it had to be modern. They had to get rid of all of that stuff. So what you have are these performances, and you can skim through just about any collection of images from Bayreuth Festival productions from 1950 until the present, and it's all hyper modern, just giant discs, completely open space. Right? The costumes would just be like either white robes or leather jackets. Right? Anything they can do to disconnect the opera from that folkish Germanic cultural imagery. And if you do something that's too traditional, you're going to be attacked in the German newspapers for being a fascist. You will be attacked for saying no. If you start using trees and there are really swords and they're, you know, they really look like knights in shining armor again, you're slipping back into that Germanic folkish style. So this is the impact that it's had on the productions, this kind of thing. The feminine half of Brabant society, however, left much to be desired. Hust posed derisive questions. Now, which one is the one whom he, maybe that nanny goat there on the off-the-shoulder dress, or the fat cow with the gold hoop. So, Hust is just seeing these women and sort of analyzing at that level. Dietrich was on the verge of deciding that the black-haired lady with the corset was the one for him, when he noticed in time that she was the one who did not appear in an irreproachable light in the whole affair. So their minds are not focusing on the opera, and probably if you really got into opera-goers' minds, it would be more like, well, what do I have to do after the opera? Geez, am I going to make it here? My butt's so sore. I don't know if I'm going to sit here this long. Is it really 4 hours long? I don't get it. But, you know, he's giving them the benefit of the doubt that at least they're sort of looking at what's going on down there. Page 252. Alas, German loyalty was threatened even here, where it appeared in all its glory, by the Jewish machinations of the dark-haired race. Bing! This is interesting. Right? For all of that controversy, here's some evidence from the time, somewhere between 1906 and 1914, Heinrich Mann is saying, those people are looking at the dark-haired antagonistic figures in Wagner's opera and saying, Jew. Okay, so that's interesting evidence. Elsa's appearance removed all doubt as to which side could truly be characterized by the notion of class. The worthy king need not have handled the matter with such objectivity. Elsa's decidedly German Germanic cast, her flowing blonde hair, the deportment so becoming of her race, offered from the beginning certain guarantees. So you have Elsa, the blonde, and what's the other character's figure? Telramund. I should know what it is. Yeah. Ortrud. Looking Jewish. Further down on page 252. Lohengrin could make his appearance. He came. He sparkled. He sent away the enchanted swan. He sparkled even more entrancingly. Vassals, noblemen, and king all succumbed to the same astonishment that befell Dietrich. Higher powers did not exist for nothing. Indeed, the highest power of all was embodied here, glaring enchantingly, be it the helmet of the swan or that of the eagle. Elsa knew very well why she fell plump upon her knees before him. Okay, so Mann feels that Dietrich is looking at Lohengrin, seeing this medieval imagery, this knight in shining armor, golden helmet, sending off the swan boat that brought him there, and projecting a hierarchical notion of society culminating in a absolute ruler as the ideal. So this just sort of feeds into the Wilhelmine system with Wilhelm at the top. Okay, over on page 253. The well-rested noblemen and vassals were then informed by Fatty Dilich that by the grace of God, they now had a new sovereign. Only yesterday they had stood by Telramund, loyal and true. Today they were true and loyal subjects of Lohengrin. They allowed themselves no opinion and swallowed everything placed before them. Okay? And he says, we'll bring the Reichstag around to that point before long. So he's definitely projecting this conservative, right-wing Germanic perspective onto Wagner. This is, according to Mann, people are doing that in between 1906 and 1914. Okay. When Ortrud wanted to enter the cathedral ahead of Elsa, however, Gusta was incensed. That really isn't necessary. I hate it when she does that, especially since she hasn't anything left, and just on general principle. Jewish impudence, Dietrich muttered. So again, he sees Ortrud as a Jewish foil to the perfect blonde Aryan Elsa. Okay, 254, in the middle. Finally he found the door, and Lohengrin and Elsa on the sofa busied themselves with the bliss that only God knows, bestows. Well, here's that sensual, sexual part of Wagner. It's there in the music, and generally suggested in the storylines, but the music has this capacity of conveying that passionate side. So Mann didn't miss that here. At first, the embraces involved only the upper body. The lower part sat as far from one another as possible. The more they sang, however, the closer they sidled up to each other, whereby their faces turned frequently toward Hainish. Hainish and his orchestra seemed to fan the flame of their passion. Orchestra fanning the flame of their passion. It was understandable, for Dietrich and Gusta, as well in their quiet box, panted softly and cast each other burning glances. Their feelings were swept along in the wake of the enchanting tones that Hainish teased forth with his flailing limbs, and their hands followed in turn. Dietrich let his slide down between Gusta's seat and her back. He encircled her below and murmured in rapture, the first time I saw that, I said to myself, she's the one. Okay. Now, it's a little bit ham-fisted, you might say, and maybe there is a satirical element here. because those of you who were in class last semester know that Thomas Mann backed a couple of scenes where the characters were embracing forbidden love of one form or another, and they're backed with Wagner. And Wagner's in the text, Wagner's the symbol that these passions are rising up. Okay? And there's sensuality and sexuality taking place. Okay? So Heinrich might be parodying his brother a little bit. Right? But in doing so, he's acknowledging that, you know, this music, at least it has that reputation or that kind of impact, even on people like Dietrich and Husted, who don't know much else otherwise. Right? So it's there. Okay, 256. This is where it comes down a little bit more directly. The couple made up on the way home. "This is the art we need," cried Dietrich. "This is German art." For here, he felt, all patriotic demands were fulfilled. In the words as well as in the music, rebellion was tantamount to crime in this world. So he sees it as he reads it as anti-leftist, not knowing anything about Wagner's background, right? But that's what he perceives it as. The existing, the legitimate, were celebrated with splendor. And so the status quo in a hierarchical system with semi-feudal elements still on the surface of an increasingly modern state. The highest value was placed on nobility, on the grace of God. And the masses, a chorus perpetually surprised by the events which transpired, surged willingly into battle against the enemies of their lords. The warlike underpinnings and the mystical spires, both of these were thus maintained. Furthermore, it struck a familiar and reassuring chord that in this world the man was the one more richly endowed with beauty and favor. Right, so it's a misogynistic element. Thus was the music, for its part, full of manly bliss, heroic in its luxuriance and patriotic even in its ardor. Who could resist? 1,000 performances of such an opera, and there would be no one left who was not nationally disposed. Dietrich pronounced, "The theater is one of my weapons as well," speaking as the king, or as the emperor. A lèse majesté trial would be hard put to rouse the citizens so thoroughly for them from their slumber. I may have sent Lauer to prison, but I take my hat off to the man who wrote Lohengrin. He proposed a telegram of approval to Wagner. Husted had to explain to him that this was no longer possible. By the way, for those of you who didn't know, Wagner's long dead before any of this. Just so you know. I mean, maybe you wouldn't know that. Wagner's, you know, is gone, you know, before any of this folkish interpretation of his music. So just you know, this is an introductory class. You may not know that either, just as Dietrich didn't. Having once embarked on such a lofty flight of thought, Dietrich began to expound upon art in general. There existed among the various arts an order of precedence. The highest is music. Okay. Now, I don't know why. Well, he does play the piano. That's right. You know, I'm just thinking here. He does play the piano. He plays Schubert after he breaks up with Agnes, right? And so he is able to play. And if you can play Schubert, you know, just sit down and play it, you can play the piano. So somewhere in there he got piano lessons, which is very, very German of him. So he does have a side for music. And then you go, well, if he plays the piano, how can he be such a bastard, right? But I mean, I guess the point is that this has been incorporated into this Germanic culture at this point. And for them, the highest is music, and for this reason, it is the German art. And then comes drama. Why, asks Husted? Because it can be set to music sometimes, and because you don't have to read it. And well, and what comes after that? Portraiture, of course, because the portraits of the emperors, the rest isn't so important. And the novel, that's no art, at least not a German art, thank God. The name alone tells you that. So a little anti-French dig, but also this general anti-intellectual component to it. So Mann is obviously representing that pretty clearly, and the putting of music and drama above. Why? Because you don't have to read it. Portraiture too. You don't have to sit down and read it. Now that's what he's saying is that behind this this hierarchy. Okay, now let's see what else I marked in red. Okay, page 262. the romantic, and I mean that in terms of between a couple, elements of Wagner do have their influence on the couple as they head home. They got into a first-class carriage. He gave the porter 3 marks and pulled down the blinds. Carried on the wings of happiness, his desire for action suffered no relaxation. Huska could never have expected so amorous a temperament. "You are not like Lohengrin after all," she said. "Who resists?" Lohengrin resists the dirty deed. As she closed her eyes and began to sink back, Dietrich got up again. Like a man of iron, he stood before her, his order hanging on his breast, a man of iron with eyes aglare. "Before we go any further," he said in martial tones, "let us think of his majesty, our gracious emperor. We must keep before us the higher aim of doing honor to his majesty and of giving him capable soldiers." "Oh," cried Huska, carried away into loftier splendors by the sparkling ornament on his breast. "Is it really you, my Dietrich?" Okay, so there we are, making soldiers for Wilhelm. You can call it that in the future. Something better than the dirty deed. So, the whole next section when they go off to Italy, I'm just going to skim over or pass that by. It's hilarious. And I'll just say in general, this is Mann is tapping into some of the core elements of the German Romantic tradition, and zinging them. And I guess we can say that a lot of this can, in retrospect, but you have to know it. It's not your job to know this, but I can see that he's actually zapping his brother, because his brother's so immersed in this and so respectful of it. But one of the core traditions, really starts with Goethe, is the trip to Italy. The trip to Italy. And if you've lived in Germany long enough, you will understand it. Because you spend 6 months in Germany in one stretch, and you're just dying to get down to Italy. You just need an Italian break. You know, you're around all these Germans. You need to go down there. And Germans feel the same way. So every once in a while, when the kids get out, Germans invade the South. And, the Italians know, oh my God, they're coming again. It's the German school system's getting out, and here they come in their van. Some of you know this, right? Spain, Portugal, southern France, and they all come with their vans, and they park in the van camping areas, and there are all these Germans around all of a sudden. And, well, it's good for tourist dollars, but, right, there you are. So there's this Drang nach Süden, this draw to go to the south. Okay? That's part of German culture. And Goethe is the one who put this into sublime terms, because after he had bounced around as a young man and written Sorrows of Young Werther, and actually settled in though, and decided after that he was going to do something practical, and for many years, and really for the rest of his life, he committed himself to being the best servant of a small principality in Weimar, and worked as a statesman. He did everything. I mean, he was a Renaissance man. He didn't write that much. He was really involved with policy and with environmental issues and building and construction and development and all sorts of things. So he was the chancellor, or whatever the term was, for this territory. And but at one point he just goes, blah, I can't do this anymore, I'm going crazy, and he just goes down to Italy, and he keeps a journal. But Goethe's Italian Travels, Italienische Reise, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely, it's Goethe's travel book. And many Germans will go to Italy with Goethe's travel book in hand and go to the same places and wistfully look over the landscape and think about the classics and think about the Rome and Greek tradition and so forth. So this is where it really is put on this higher pedestal. And skipping ahead 100 years or so, Thomas's characters also have this yearning to go to the South. And the most famous one that some of you may know is Gustav Aschenbach. He's a composer, an author, an author who goes to Venice He's just got to get away from his uptight German hard work, which has produced a lot of great books, but he's never been able to relax. And when he relaxes, he needs to go somewhere. He wants to go somewhere like Brazil, with snakes and palm trees and high levels heat and humidity. That's what he visualizes, going somewhere. And of course, if you go to jungles and if you go to the Far East, you're going to run into German tourists all over. And they're all doing this thing where they get out of Germany and they explore the exotic. It's part of this romantic strain. You'll find them out there. But he settles for Venice, which is the most exotic, erotic place that he can think of and still have access to. So going to Italy and going to Venice. So his brother's setting those things up. And there he becomes self-conscious for the first time. Instead of thinking only about his work, he thinks about himself and discovers in his mid-life crisis that he's actually has an attraction to a young boy. And that's self-realization, which he's not comfortable with, but which unfolds in a beautiful way in the story. So this is Thomas Mann in enhancing and intensifying this yearning toward the South. And it has this fundamental place in German culture. Well, here's Heinrich Mann's version of it. You know, Dietrich and Huste go on their honeymoon, and what happens? Dietrich gets word that the Kaiser is there too, and spends the whole time just running around trying to protect the Kaiser and chasing his carriage around and standing in front of his buildings and guarding him from those Southerners, right, who might do whatever to him. Okay, so very funny, but that's the end. But that is, you know, in general, it has this big cultural reference there. Okay, let's go ahead to, I think I'm going to go ahead to the, just before the unveiling or the inauguration of the memorial. But before that, pages 322 and 323. Here we have just some interaction between Dietrich and Huste, and I just wanted to point this out because Mann is obviously pointing out the male dominant, male chauvinism, right, that underlies all of this as well. And if he's reading this intensively already in 1906 to 1914 when he's preparing this book, I guess, you know, we can see that, of course, it's in place in Germany and in France and the United States as well, and so, you know, it's not just na 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 you Germans, but it reminds us again that some of the more, even the more extreme aspects of National Socialist policy were not new in any way. Right? They're tapping into a pre-existing cultural framework that included the patriotism, and included the nationalism, and included the folkish references to the past and the medieval, and included anti-Semitism, and it included women should be in church and in the kitchen and taking care of kids, the three Ks. So when they institute their policy, which seems extreme as far as gender relations, just as extreme as the Holocaust almost, right? Kinder, Kirche, Küche, that's their slogan for the women of Germany. Children, church, and kitchen. Okay? And you go, oh my God, how could they do that? How could it be so flagrant? Right? Well, it was quite popular. It's quite popular. Even and German women responded quite supportively to that. In fact, if you break down the voting records, a very large representative of the percentage that supported Hitler in the general elections before the Third Reich made all of those statistics irrelevant were women. women. And we'll talk about this, but it was a reaction to the really modernization and progressive independence that women were experiencing in the Weimar period. And it was a backlash. It was a backlash against that. The German version of Rosie the Riveter and the Flappers, right? Scared women. They weren't that comfortable with it. So a large percentage of them support Nazis, and there are a number of books on women in the Third Reich, and that well, they've all been pretty consistent in showing, yeah, there was this backlash among women who supported a more traditional view of things. So, but anyway, within the nationalist culture, Mann is pointing out that people like Dietrich shared the notion that married life was very strict, top of page 122. Their son's birth was not an easy one. When it was all over, Dietrich informed his wife that if it had been necessary to choose, he would have simply allowed her to die, painful as the course would have been, he added. But the race is more important, and I am responsible to my emperor for my sons. Women were there to produce children, and Dietrich refused them any license for frivolity and impropriety. Keep to the women's sphere, he would say to Justa. Religion, cooking, and children. I didn't make that up, and in fact, I didn't even review it to see that that was the line there. I just had it marked here as, you know, so if he's writing that in 1914, okay, it's there already. It's there. In this popular culture, right? Now, as we hammer away at this, I want you to remember, there are lots of Dietrichs out there, but there are also people like Heinrich Mann. There are lots of social democrats. He's looking at this as a dangerous minority that's emerging and that he's worried about. We know that he was right to be worried about it. But it's not that every German was like Dietrich. That's the one thing I have to, you know, remind you, because there's an eye here who's observing that, and that eye is Heinrich, and he's cool. And there are other Germans who are looking at this saying, we don't like this. There's a tendency, you know, I don't want to give you this impression that it's only that, but this is their perspective on these type that's showing up. Okay, let's shift up to the monument, the inauguration of the monument, page 337, it starts roughly, and I'll skip in here to really when Dietrich starts to give his speech. But there's a build-up where all the elements of the Nazi society are showing up, and the aristocrats and the military types and the various characters that you've seen through the story are fighting for seats and trying to get in the best position for all of this. And then the band starts to play music. And by the way, it crashes out on page 337, the march of the Wartburg procession, Wagner. It's Wagner. So Mann is definitely associating Wagner with this whole scene. Okay. And then in 339, we get Dietrich's speech. And we'll go through some of the key things here, how he's incorporating major Wilhelmine themes as he unveils the monument. Now, of course, the background of this is that he and Volkov were able to manipulate things in a cynical, if not corrupt, way in order to have this monument to Wilhelm I constructed. Not Wilhelm II, but the Kaiser or the king who became Kaiser under Bismarck. Instead of constructing a children's hospital, right? So progress was definitely deferred in order to create this thing. He began, page 339. Your Excellencies, my lords and gentlemen, it is 100 years since the great emperor, whose monument is being unveiled by His Majesty's representative, was given to us into the fatherland. Oh, wait a minute. Isn't it a monument of Wilhelm? Let me check that. Anybody catch that? Emperor Wilhelm Monument. So why would it be 100 years from this?
Maybe he was born 100 years
ago. Ah, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Beautiful. Was born. Thank you. Perfect. Was given to us into the fatherland. At the same time, to lend more significance to this hour, it is almost a decade since his illustrious grandson ascended the throne. Why should we not first of all cast a proud and grateful glance over the times which we ourselves have been privileged to experience. He alternately celebrated the unparalleled upsurge of commerce and of nationalism. He discussed the ocean for a considerable time. The ocean is indispensable to the greatness of Germany. In the ocean, we have a proof that there can be no decision on the seas or beyond them without Germany and the German emperor. For today, world commerce is our chief concern. Now, that's a red flag. Right. Because it is, you know, indication that really first and foremost in his speech, a first specific thing that he's referring to is the development of a German navy, right, which was a major foreign policy issue between 1906 and 1914, the source of tremendous tension and enmity between Germany and England. And you can read the background to that in Orwell, but you'll see the naval policy of Wilhelm II. It's what really ratchets up the tension between them. Okay. Bottom quarter of page 339. Only His Majesty Dietrich. He has aroused the citizen from his slumbers. His lofty example has made us what we are. And he said this, he struck himself on the chest. You know, that's me. His personality, his unique, incomparable personality is so powerful that we can all creep up around it like clinging ivy. In whatever His Majesty the Emperor decides for the good of the German people, we will joyfully cooperate, be we nobles or commoners. So he's the example of that. He's basically made his own identity out of this. 340. Rendering efficient to an astonishing degree, full of the highest moral strength for positive action, and in our shining armor, right? So incorporating this medieval imagery into 20th century politics, the terror of all enemies who enviously threaten us. We are the elite among nations and represent an unprecedented height of German master culture, which will never be surpassed by any people, be they who they may. Okay. Here is, you know, a direct expression of this folkish notion of German Kultur as superior to all others, of master culture. And as crazy as it sounds, there are just page after page, and I have the previous class read about 200 of them, of people like Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who are literally, are very intensively arguing that German culture is the pinnacle of Western civilization, that it encompasses the Renaissance, it encompasses the Greek classical age, that's all Germanic. And what you see in Germany in the 19th and 20th century is the culmination of all of that. A master nation, however, does not achieve such an incomparable flowering in the slackness of peaceful ease. Right? So here comes the militarism. No, our ancient ally has deemed it necessary to test the German gold with fire. We had to pass through the fiery furnaces of Jena and Tilsit. That's wars of revolution against Napoleon. And in the end, we have been able to plant our victorious colors everywhere and to forge the imperial crown of Germany upon the field of battle. Okay, so the militarism speaks for itself. Down at the bottom, here's some of that medievalism. In the Middle Ages, Wilhelm the Great would have been canonized. Oh, wouldn't it be great if we could go back to that? But instead, we erect a first-class monument to his memory. Page 341, we have direct attacking of Napoleon III of France. Dietrich took it upon himself to describe conditions in the empire of Napoleon III, poisoned by democracy and therefore abandoned by God. Crass materialism, concealed by hollow piety, had given rise to the most unscrupulous commercialism. Okay, so see the things that they don't like. Mann's got his good ear for this. Materialism. Commercialism. This contempt for the soul found its natural ally in a degraded hedonism. So, decadent behavior, urban behavior, sexuality, sensuality. Publicity mongering was the dominant impulse of public life, and at every moment it degenerated into a mania for persecution. Right? So publicity, mass newspapers will say, you know, Britney Spears 24/7, you know, that kind of thing. That's what they, you know, he's saying that's what the French are into. Relying outwardly upon prestige, but inwardly upon the police, with no other creed but force. One strove only for theatrical effects, making great pomp with the heroic periods of the past, but chauvinism was the only pinnacle which was ever attained. Okay. Now, I think you see Heinrich Mann using a little satire there. Of that, we know nothing. Of course, his whole book has shown that that latter portion, using the police, no creed but force, theatrical effects, pomp of the past, and chauvinism, that's exactly what he's basically demonstrated the Wilhelmine culture to be full of. Of that we know nothing. Right. Therefore, there can never, never be for us that terrible end which awaited the empire of our hereditary foe. And that would be the defeat of France in the Franco-Prussian War at Sedan. That's what he's referring back to. Right. So that this assumption, France has been defeated, maybe for good, that may run through the Wilhelmine culture here. Page 342. The turbid stream of democracy, Dietrich screamed, flows increasingly from the land of our hereditary foe. So democracy, add that to the list. That's to be defeated and stemmed and defeated. German manliness and German idealism can alone dam the tide. The unpatriotic enemies of the divine world order, however, who wish to undermine our political system, and here's that language, they must be exterminated, root and branch. Okay? This is an indication that, as a historian, you need to pay attention to this. Mann is telling us, in writing in 1914, there's no way he could have known, right? That language was around, that the enemies of the state need to be exterminated. Now, it may seem like a bad joke then, right? But it's there. It's in their discourse, and he's captured it for us there. Right? And that's just an opportunity for me to remind you. It's an important point that should come out later, but if it doesn't, here it is. What's the first group? The first group that the Nazis arrested, incarcerated, and began to kill. Right. It's the left. It's the communists and socialists. Right. That's when the system was first established for the detention centers, right, that become concentration camps, that become killing camps. But that comes later. The process begins with the killing of the left. Right? And that happens right after the, really after the seizure of power in that summer, but especially after the burning of the Reichstag fire. And that's the excuse that they use to go and boom and put them away. So the Jews are definitely targeted, but they're second. The first target is the left. Right? So that Staatsstreich, and the language of exterminating the political enemies, first applies to the left. Now, as he's saying things like that, at these words, Dietrich hit his chest so hard that he knocked the wind out of himself. The civilian stand seized upon the unavoidable pause which ensued and showed by its restlessness that it regarded the speech as finished. The storm had now come up directly over the heads of the festive guard gathering, and in the sulphurous light, these raindrops, as big as hen's eggs, kept falling singly, slowly, like a warning. Now, when this monument is unveiled, he began with renewed vigor, when flags and standards are drooped in reverence, swords are lowered and bayonets flash at the command, present arms. Just at this moment, there was such a formidable crash in the heavens that Dietrich ducked his head, and before he knew what he was doing, he had crept under the podium. Fortunately, he emerged again before anyone had noticed him disappear, so he's, fundamentally a coward, right? But the heavens are literally commenting on what he's saying. They scarcely paid any attention as Dietrich requested His Excellency the Governor General to be so as kind as to order that the monument be unveiled. In the name of His Majesty, I declare this monument to be unveiled, and the covering fell to the strains of the Sentry on the Rhine. That's a very famous military song from the 19th century Romantic period. Wilhelm the Great riding through the air, looking like a good paterfamilias, though surrounded by all the terrors of authority, and the sight of the emperor again steeled his loyal subjects against the threats from the sky. Okay. The national anthem is performed. We heard it, and it was probably that first stanza that was performed, not the third. Then it was Hessling's turn to be introduced as the spiritual creator of the monument and to be decorated when the heavens burst. They burst completely all at once with such a force as to suggest a long-delayed explosion. So just as he's getting his award for this, right, shrieking crowds struggled right and left in the moist entanglement. The officers brought their bared swords to play against the elements and were able to cut their way through the canvas to freedom. So officers are pulling out their swords and beating people out of the way, so all of that honor and dignity and so on is destroyed. Right? And so forth, it goes on. He gets his medal on the top of page 344. Right? Two-thirds of the way through, 344. The regimental band continued to play the national anthem, even after the military cordon and the world order had collapsed. They played like the orchestra on a sinking ship to the accompaniment of terror and disillusion. Another burst of the hurricane dispersed even them, and Dietrich, with his eyes squeezed shut and a dizzying sense that the end of everything was imminent, sank back into the cool depths beneath the podium, to which he clung like it was the last thing on earth. So, you know, this whole world that Dietrich has constructed is just being swept away. Being swept along by the whips from on high, under streams of fire, this clean out, like the end of a drunken masquerade, a swept together heap of nobles and commoners, the most distinguished uniform, and the citizen aroused from his slumbers, pillar of the state and heaven-sent statesman, ideal riches, hussars, lancers, dragoons, and army service corps. The horsemen of the apocalypse rode on, as Dietrich noticed. All the time, Dietrich had a feeling that the monument had been smashed and washed away. So the heavens have just opened up on this patriotic farce. And it's really this section that in 1918 is held up and read as the prediction. He predicted it. He predicted that this world was going to be washed away and blown apart, which it was, in the trenches of Flanders from 1914 to 1918. So all of this bombast and Wilhelmine pomp and aggressiveness and chauvinism that is manifested in his speech and in the unveiling of this monument, Mann has it trigger this hurricane, as it was indeed triggering a hurricane in European politics and German life. Now, just a final epilogue here. Dietrich gets away from the event, and he's heading home, but he notices that the door is open at the Buck household, his nemesis, this alter ego, if you will, the Buck family. And he actually works his way inside the house, is able to look in, and what he sees is that old Buck, the tradition, the representative of the 1848 dream that Germany could be constructed in a different way, that it could be a liberal, democratic system. Maybe not all the way to socialism, but something progressive, is dying. Dietrich actually gets up to the point so he can look into the room and see him on his deathbed. And as he does, on page 347, his face was turned in Dietrich's direction, and where his eyes were fixed, one divined more than was actually there, visions that no one could obstruct. As these visions appeared, reflected in his astonished eyes, he opened out his arms on the pillows, tried to lift them, and did so, moving them in a gesture of welcome. Whom was he welcoming? How many were there to whom he made these prolonged sighs and signs of beckoning? A whole nation, apparently. But of what character that its coming should awaken the spectral joy in the countenance of old Buck? So, I mean, you can only guess, but it may be just this vision of a better Germany, or a more democratic Germany, and these could be all of his comrades from 1848, who maybe they're coming back from Milwaukee. Right? He's welcoming him back. Then he suddenly gave a start, as if he had met a stranger with a message of terror. He was frightened and struggled for breath. Facing him, Dietrich held himself even more stiffly, puffed out his chest with its black, white, and red sash, those are the monarchical colors, and its decorations, and glared on general principles. Suddenly the old man's head dropped. His dream is shattered. Right? He fell forward, right over, as though he'd been broken. His family shrieked. In a horrified whisper, the eldest son's wife cried, "He's seen something. He has seen the devil." Judith Lauer got up slowly and shut the door. Dietrich had vanished. So, from the social democratic perspective, which is Heinrich Mann's, I think he associates himself with Buck's, the Buck view, Dietrich's the devil, and this book was dedicated to depicting that. The forces, cultural, that became political, which certainly were behind policy leading from 1910 to 1914, as Orlo spells out, and as we'll talk about in a minute, and ultimately, let's say not shirking the opportunity to go to war, whether we're going to say they actually triggered it or not. It's more complicated than that, but certainly not shirking it, and to a certain degree, looking forward to it. So let's take a break, and then we'll come back and talk about that outcome and move toward remarks, All Quiet on the Western Front.